Down to business on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland. Whether you're starting or growing your business, we have a range of solutions to help.
This is News Talk.
Mandy Johnston here, still standing in for Bobby on Down to Business. Now, we're going to turn to a new book that is out, and I'm going to be speaking to the author. If the US presidential election has shown us anything this week, it's that we're living in a world where holding an opinion that differs from other people's opinion might actually see you coming into conflict with families, friends, and even your work colleagues. So if you're a manager, how do you make sure that the conflict of opinion doesn't actually interrupt or disturb your business? Well, my next guest has just published that new book, which might be able to help you out. And it's a great welcome to Karthik Ramana, who's Professor of Business and Public Policy at the University of Oxford's Blavatnik School of Government. He is the author of that book. It's called The Age of Outrage. Karthik, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you for having me, Mandy.
I just picked up this book during the week and I'm almost halfway through it. It's so fascinating as a concept. Why did you write this book at this time? What drew you to it?
Well, I actually wrote it in part to help me in my own day job. I found myself the director of the public leadership program at Oxford, where we educated about 1,000 public leaders from 120 countries. And it occurred to me that we should have some sort of framework to make sure that we do more good than harm in bringing all these very smart people together and helping them create conditions where they can work together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you start thinking about living in a world of outrage, you think that it's just some kind of new phenomenon because of social media. But of course, it's been prevalent in, I suppose, society always, but maybe heightened now. Why do you think we're feeling a heightened sense of outrage at the moment?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's so many factors that are really adding into this. There's so much fear about how AI is going to change our lives on a scale perhaps even greater than the Industrial Revolution did. The impact of climate change, shifting demographics and aging societies. But you leap onto all of this, the idea that, you know, trust in institutions, trust in governments is at perhaps the lowest it's been since before World War II. So people don't trust their leaders to really drive policies in the wider interests of society. And then, of course, you've got sort of a growing sense of othering, you know, viewing the world and sort of sense of us versus them, our reverting to our tribal mindsets.
Yeah, all three of those really evident in that US presidential discussion, debate, discourse. But, you know, what are the antidotes to dealing with that, particularly in a work environment I'm interested in? Because one of the things that kind of struck me as I was going through it is we have a lot of businesses who might have multi-generational issues when it comes to debating certain things. So what are your recommendations for how people can approach this in a work environment to sort of take the temperature down if you get into that situation?
That's right. The first thing is really to be prepared, because you can't in this age not expect to be caught in, you know, one of the crossfires of these kinds of political conversations. So really smart leaders are getting ahead of the game. They're thinking about who are their potential antagonists on these issues, and they're reaching out to them before there's a crisis. So create the conditions where you have trust and you have channels of active listening. So that you can actually understand what will be the right way to de-escalate a situation when it does present itself.
Yeah.
And the second thing, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Please continue.
Yeah. And the second thing is, you know, you really want to understand what are the issues to say yes to and what are the issues to stay silent on. Mm. And some of that is really a function of your corporate strategy. You know, if you're a company like Disney that's in the business of cultural entertainment, you can't afford to say, oh, we don't do politics, because everything you do is about politics, right? Culture shapes politics. That would be different if, say, you're an oil company, because, you know, of course, there's a different element of politics you'd engage in around climate change, but you don't need to take a view on cultural issues. So different businesses need to lean in and lean out of issues differently.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting, because we just had a big discussion with some sports journalists about their world and how it has changed. And they were making the point that, you know, the sports journalists and the sports department used to be seen as the sort of toy department in an organization, a news organization. But now, of course, it spans everything, business, politics, and they've got to be aware of everything around them. One of the things that the book does really well, I think, Karthik, is look at some examples that demonstrate that this is not a new phenomenon. And I'm particularly thinking here about the example that you have about IKEA. Maybe you could take us through what that was back in 2012.
Yeah, so IKEA has had a long presence in many countries. Obviously, it's very prominent in Europe and North America, which is a core part of its business. But it's also been present in Saudi Arabia. And it's, in fact, been in Saudi Arabia since 1983. And of course, Saudi Arabia at the time was a very conservative country. It still is conservative by Western standards. And so IKEA, as it was issuing its catalogs in that country, decided that the best way to get around the censors was to airbrush out the images of its women who were dressed in, you know, Western or Scandinavian clothing, to airbrush out the images of women in the catalog, because otherwise the catalog would be censored and, you know, they wouldn't be able to circulate it in the country. Mm. So if there was a picture that involved, say, a father, a mother, and two kids, then the mother would be taken out and it's just the father and the two kids that would be left in. Now, from Western sensibility, this might seem absurd, but it worked in IKEA's context in Saudi Arabia for a while. But of course, you know, these things are not static and things change and Saudi cultures and norms are changing. And of course, you know, the internet meant that these catalogs, which really only circulated within Saudi Arabia, were now available at a click anywhere in the world. And this, when this came to light, IKEA found itself in real hot water, because this is a very progressive company in the West. This is a company that way back in the 1990s was running same-sex commercials, you know. So for a company like that to then have a regressive view like taking out the images of women in its catalog, it just sort of jarred as hypocrisy. And IKEA then had to go through some great lengths to clean that up.
And what did they do? Like, how did they manage that situation ultimately?
Well, in this particular situation, they, you know, they had sort of made a decision that perhaps worked in the 1980s and then sort of just stuck with it, perhaps out of an abundance of caution. Mm. And they hadn't kept, you know, they hadn't kept pace with changing times. Mm. So then when this crisis erupted, of course, you know, there were threats of boycotting IKEA products in Northern Europe. And this would be, of course, enormously costly to the company. So they decided to take a risk and reissue the catalog in Saudi Arabia, just as it would appear in Europe or in North America. And lo and behold, you know, it was no longer an issue in Saudi Arabia.
And that's a great example of something that, you know, you're not planning for the outrage. It's the consequence that happens because of some of your business practices that the outrage develops. So you've talked us through the sort of planning ahead piece and what companies should do there. But maybe about the managers themselves who are trying to manage these situations. What kind of skills do they need to have or show to demonstrate that they can manage a team of diverse opinions?
That's a great question. And I think that one of the most important aspects or properties of leadership we need in this time is temperance. Mm. The classical Greeks talked about courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance as the four virtues. And we've spent a lot of time, you know, building out leaders as courageous and justice and wise, just and wise. And that's wonderful. But the thing that we've perhaps underemphasized is the value of temperance. You know, temperance gets a bad rap because people think of temperance as something that entails compromise and someone who has really no values or no position and is willing to sort of be swayed opportunistically by the winds. But some of the most compelling leaders of the last few years, like Nelson Mandela and Yitzhak Rabin, they were very temperate leaders. They were leaders who stood for very strong positions, but at the same time knew how to create the space for diverse voices to be heard. So, you know, in a business today, of course, you have to decide what are things you lean in and what are things you lean out of. But you can't afford to say to your employees who are your core asset, oh, well, don't bring your identities to work. Because if you said that, you'll probably not have the same, you know, you won't be able to attract or retain the same employee pool. So, you know, thinking about this in the context of temperate leadership is perhaps one of the most important things you've got to do today.
Yes, such an important point. And employees, such an important part now in the war for talent and everything, that you've got to be mindful of them and allow them to have their opinions. Karthik, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. The book is called The Age of Outrage. And that was Karthik Ramana, Professor of Business and Public Policy at the University of Oxford's Blavatnik School of Government. Thank you very much for joining us today.